Right, speakers turn right down, so I hope that you can manage to hear me okay. Let me start with a story which I think is probably getting to be familiar to most of us now. And my preferred version of it is the one where two party members are walking down the street and a few yards in front of them somebody stumbles and falls. And the first party member rushes forward to help them up. And the second party member shouts after the first party member, "You bloody reformist." Now, if nothing else, I think this story shows that it's possible to misunderstand the party's position on reformism. So what is the position? Well, we all know the basics. The party has socialism and nothing else as its aim, and it canvasses support solely on that basis. It doesn't campaign for immediate reforms of capitalism. It also rejects the idea that working for reforms is any way to transform capitalism itself. So the party isn't opposed to reforms. It doesn't advocate them, but it acknowledges that some reforms can bring benefits to some workers. What it is opposed to is reformism. And we can take reformism to be any movement which has as its aim some change to capitalist society rather than its complete overthrow. And we can take its overthrow to involve the ending of the wages system, the ending of non-communal ownership of productive resources, and an end to the subordination of use value to exchange value, or to put it in more user-friendly terms, the subordination of human need to profit-making. Now, notice something about this. Reformism can come in at least two different forms. Someone can pursue reformist policies because they think that that's the best we can do. And I can think of at least one ex-party member that I know who came to the conclusion that socialism was a pipe dream, the best we could do was take the roughest edges off capitalism. So that's one kind of reformism. The other kind is someone can think that socialism is possible, and they can think that the way to get to a socialist society is by a kind of policy of attrition, removing its undesirable effects and gradually building up a support for replacing it. And it's really that second kind of reformism that I'll be concerned with. We know what the party's basic position is. There's another question that you might raise. What would the party's position be if and when we start getting socialists elected to legislative bodies, to parliament, to local councils and so on? And here's what the party says in the pamphlet, "The Market System Must Go." It says, "Any socialist elected to parliament or to local councils would be delegated by the Socialist Party to treat individual reforms that came to their attention on their merits, principally as to whether they would benefit the working class at large, or indeed the movement for socialism in particular. At all times, however, socialists would refrain from advocating specific reforms of capitalism or supporting organisations wanting to reform this or that aspect of the system." Now, I mentioned that we may want to come back to that in the discussion. I suspect that the second party member in my story might not be very happy with it. Okay, well, let me say one more thing by way of preliminary. I think that the party's position on reformism is really essentially what makes it distinctive. If you look hard enough, you'll find other groups that talk about abolishing the wages system, about common ownership of resources, about the need for people to act politically for themselves rather than trusting leaders, not to go cap in hand to the state, etc. But try to find a group which says all of these things together and says that it's a distraction to engage in immediate reformist struggles, and you'll look for a much longer time. This is what's distinctive of the party's position. Okay, what reasons are there for adopting this position? Let me give you three. Well, three and a half, really, we'll get to that. First of all, there's a danger that a socialist party which advocated reforms would attract the support of people more interested in the reforms than in socialism. And in those circumstances, the likelihood is that the party would be dragged into compromise with capitalism, and it would, in the end, become another reform party, even if it still proclaimed socialism as its ultimate aim. The second thing is this: if the party adopted reformist strategies, it would no longer be so clear how much support there was for a wholesale social change. And I think this is more important than it might seem at first. Socialism requires the active support of a majority of people, and it's vital that we have some way of measuring what degree of support exists at any given historical moment. Now, one index will be the size of the membership of the World Socialist Movement. I don't think that will be the only measure. My own speculation is that as socialist consciousness grew, people would not necessarily join the World Socialist Movement. They'd be quite capable of organising things for themselves. And we might get a few shocks. We might be surprised how little notice they took of the resolutions that we passed at conference or whatever. But if that movement itself adopted reformist measures, if some people who joined the party were more interested in reforms than they are in revolutionary change, we wouldn't be able to rely on the size of that movement as an indicator of the general level of support for socialism. And that's a serious matter, because you can't have a society of voluntary association unless people are positively committed to it in a majority number. Third, and most seriously of all, there are severe limits on how successful reformist campaigns can be. You can't just have capitalism as you like, it has its own imperatives. And if the reforms are incompatible with the imperatives of capitalism, for example, if they go against the need to maximise profits, then they will simply not succeed. If you think about it, this is all confirmed by overwhelming historical evidence. In the last 100 years, the massively greater political effort has gone into reforming capitalism rather than replacing it. And in that time, not one of the major problems that it throws up has been disposed of. War, poverty, famine, obscene inequality, an insecure material existence for millions on millions of people, all of these are still with us. So, in a way, it's as if there'd been a gigantic social experiment stretching over many decades. And the experiment is to see whether reformism works. And we test it by enlisting the support of millions of people in many different places and in many different conditions. And we've now had more than a century of political movements which said that they could combine reformism with a revolutionary strategy. And they've attracted many supporters in many different circumstances. And in every case, they've ended up endorsing some form of capitalism, and there has been no socialist revolution. Well, that provides strong evidence that the reformist and revolutionary strategies just can't be combined. One will always lose out against the other. And I'm reminded of Einstein's famous definition of insanity as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. The reformist strategy has been tried over and over again, and always with the same result. So it would be very nice, wouldn't it, if we could say to someone, look, that experiment has run, now it's time for a different experiment. Let's have millions of people committing to building a socialist society and see what the result of that is. Now, I want to raise another question. We know what the party's position is on reformism. What follows from this for individual party members? We all have to live in capitalism until it's replaced. Are we expected to act as the party rightly does and never advocate or work for any reforms? Well, that's quite a demanding position. You may feel very strongly that your local hospital shouldn't close or that NHS funding shouldn't be limited, and you may feel that you have to do something about this. Well, I wouldn't rush to criticise anyone who felt like this, but I would emphasise the point that different reforms will benefit different members of the working class, so that reforms are not an area for detecting interests which everybody can share. And generally, I think the only thing that you can do as a socialist living in a capitalist society is to adopt a kind of stance. And this is a metaphor. Some of you will remember our late comrade Ron Cook. And it's a metaphor which I first heard from him. And I think it's a useful one. A boxer adopts a stance, and from that they can move into various positions to deal with what's coming at them in a lot of different ways. And they do that rather than rigidly in one position at the outset and never moving from it. Now, that metaphor, I think, conveys the position that anyone in capitalism is in. It throws many things at you, different things at different people. And as well as being socialists, we somehow have to negotiate that fact, and we have to defend our particular interests as best we can. We have to make a hard judgment about how much of our time to devote to working for socialism and how much to agitating for higher wages, defending attacks on the health service, supporting calls for safer roads, doing something about homeless people, etc., 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 etc. And I could spend the rest of this talk just saying etc., because that's the number of problems that capitalism throws up for different individual members of that society. Let me illustrate the point I'm making here with the Brexit referendum. Now, one member of our branch resigned from the party because he owned the Socialist Standard, and the Socialist Standard said Brexit would make no difference to the working class. He knew that it might well make a difference to him because his partner was German and she stood to lose the right to remain in the UK if Brexit was carried. Now, I won't mince my words. I think the party does itself no favours by talking in that way. Brexit does make a difference to members of the working class, and it's just crazy to deny it. The point is, it will affect different people in different ways, and there will be some who gain from it and some who lose. Now, that makes it a divisive issue, and that's one reason for the party itself not to take a stand on the issue of Brexit. Anything that threatens working class unity is to be avoided. But what the party itself does is a separate matter from what an individual member might do. But the further reason for the party as an organisation not to take a stand on the issue is this. There will always be different...
I think we've lost you, Keith.
I think we have, and he won't be able to hear, will he? What I'll do is I'll boot him off, and then he'll realise that he has to come back on. I think that's the only thing we can do. And that'll kind of reactivate the sounder, hopefully. Question is, will he notice?
Or put a message?
Yeah, we'll send...
Put a message on the message channel.
If he's...
on it.
Yeah, we'll do that.
Or better still, someone phoning.
We might come to that if someone's got his phone number.
Well, will he answer?
Yeah.
I can phone him, yeah.
Hello?
Oh, there you are. He's back again.
Yeah.
Yeah, we lost you there for a bit, Keith, sorry.
Okay. Did you hear my message?
We lost you about three or four minutes ago.
Okay, how far have I got?
Nice.
So you were saying etc., 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 etc.
Ah, okay.
No, it was over that.
Yeah.
No.
You got beyond that.
No, I haven't gone that far at all. couple of paragraphs, maybe about 2.5 minutes tops.
Okay, so I'll go back to the etc., shall I?
Yeah. No, it's too far back, Keith. Too far back.
For fuck's sake.
All right.
Okay, so it seems like different people have lost them at different points. So I'm just going to have to make a judgment and dive in, okay? I hope that's all right for people.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. And I'll turn my mic down again.
Don't you have to turn your speakers down, Keith?
Okay, so...
You could just...
The party's position is one thing. The position of individual members within it is another. It's compatible with the party's position for individual members to hold views about this or that way of organising capitalism and to give expression to them and to act on them. Now, personally, I would rather live in a non-Brexit capitalism than I would in Brexit capitalism. But most of all, I'd rather not live in capitalism at all. And I think the party was and is right to focus exclusively on that issue. Okay, now, what I next want to do, and I hope you'll forgive me for this, what I want to do is zap you with a philosophical argument. Some of you know that I used to be a professor of philosophy, and I'm afraid that old habits die hard. So here's a philosophical argument, and it's about the role of voting. In almost all public elections, your vote will make no difference to the outcome. Those elections were almost never decided by one vote. There were in local elections earlier this year, there were a couple of dead heats, but it's massively unusual for that to happen. And I don't know of any parliamentary election where it's happened. So, whether you turn up to vote or not, the outcome is going to be the same. You turn up and vote, you don't turn up and vote, the result just is still the same. Of course, if everyone thought that way and stayed away, there wouldn't be any result, but we're talking about you and your vote. So, what follows from this fact that the result doesn't change depending on whether you go along and vote or not? Well, some people conclude that you've got no good reason for going to vote, so you shouldn't bother. Stay at home and read the Socialist Standard instead. But I think this is a mistake. Your vote may not affect the outcome, but it may still have effects. It may still have a role to play. I mean, for one thing, you can go to vote as a way of reminding yourself and other people who you are and what you believe in. So, think of how this is played out in the context of the referendum. I was relieved of the burden of determining the outcome of the referendum. That's going to be the same whether I turn up or not. So that liberates me to express my deeply held socialist convictions on the ballot paper. Why should I confine myself to voting for or against Brexit when the abolition of capitalism is massively more important to me? And bear in mind that when I wrote my socialist message on the ballot paper, it was seen by at least two people, the teller and the returning officer. And in more usual contexts, this increases to at least six people. A minimum of two candidates, plus their agents, plus the teller, plus the returning officer. So my vote will receive more attention than the vote of some person who goes in and votes for one of the candidates. That's to say, the people I like to think of as spoiling their ballot paper by voting for capitalism. So the attention that my vote receives gives reason enough to go to the polling station. And you have to feel for the returning officer and all those other people who have to look at a ballot paper and decide what the voter's intention was. I remember one case where the voter had written the word wanker against the name of every candidate except one, where they'd written OK. And then the returning officer had to decide whether this was an intention to vote for that person or not. There's also another case of one party member who aspired to write the whole of the Declaration of Principles on the ballot paper. But unfortunately, the pencil got too blunt and the The police officer on duty got too suspicious before he could complete the task. Now, I've said that the party's position on reformism is distinctive. Let me mention another distinctive position the party holds. In the 1930s, we published a pamphlet, Why Capitalism Will Not Collapse. Now, there's been a recurrent optimism about this since, at least since Marx's day. Marx thought it was inevitable that capitalism would collapse. He also thought it was not inevitable. In other words, he contradicted himself. I mean, you couldn't write as much as Marx did without contradicting yourself. But, for example, in the manifesto, he argues that the fall of the capitalist class and the victory of the proletarians are equally inevitable. And he thought that was because capitalism unintentionally fosters solidarity amongst workers. As he put it, capitalism produces its own grave diggers. But if you look at Capital, or at least if you wade through as far as chapter 28, you'll find Marx saying this: the advance of capitalist production develops a working class which, by education, tradition, and habit, looks upon the requirements of that mode of production as self-evident natural laws. And that's because the ideology of capitalism is so powerful in shaping people's views that they think that nothing else is possible. And interestingly, that second view was echoed in an article in the Standard for August by Glenn Morris, where he says the power of a capitalist society to engineer the way the majority of people think is so powerful. The belief that buying the latest item of shoddily made tat will somehow make you a better, happier, or more fulfilled person seems now to be hardwired into the masses. So, we've got these two views. We've got the view that the demise of capitalism is inevitable, and the view that capitalism conditions people to accept it as natural, nothing else is possible. But I would say that on the historical evidence, we've got a lot more reason to believe the second of those than we have the first. So, that pamphlet was a useful corrective to the views being expressed by various left-wing groups at that time. There's nothing inevitable about the downfall of capitalism because people have to choose consciously to end it. Otherwise, capitalism staggers on from crisis to crisis. The trade cycle continues with massive suffering for millions of people who get thrown out of work during the downturn. But notice something about this. This only shows that there's nothing in the basic dynamics of capitalism which dictates a collapse. What we've currently been made aware of is that there are many contingent reasons why capitalism might well collapse. There's always the possibility of nuclear war put on the back burner to some extent in recent years, but it's still there. There's the possibility of poisoning of the planet and climate change. And we're beset by multiple threats, and these have been very well covered in recent copies of the Standard. Now, these threats to our very existence as a species might well seduce people into reformism. They're so great that people might think, well, sorry, we have to shelve the work of socialism until they've been dealt with. But again, with the historical evidence, we should have learned the futility of that approach. The criterion for action in capitalism has to be profitability. It can't be human welfare. Capitalism, as I said at the start, has its own dynamics. And that really already limits how much we can do to counter these threats. So we just can't take that chance. It's the establishment of socialism that needs to be addressed now so that these other threats can themselves be addressed directly. So what I conclude from this is the party's opposition to reformism is completely historically justified. And if we started supporting reformist campaigns, this would be no more than a spit in the ocean of reformism. And reformism itself is no more than a spit in the ocean of the problems thrown up by capitalism. Capitalism is a very dangerous place. as a friend of mine put it, we have to abolish capitalism before capitalism abolishes us. So what I think we need is a slightly amended coda to the Communist Manifesto. It says the proletarians have nothing to lose but their chains, they have a whole world to win. Well, yes, we have got a whole world to win, but we'd better get a move on. Capitalism's a dangerous place, and this offer may not last forever. When it's gone, it's gone. So that's why not reformism. Thank you very much.